Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 30, Harry Potter Voices Across Borders, where we will be talking with Imbalia Thomas, as well as Rafael Carnero and Amy Quirin, about the power of the Harry Potter books to help us speak and teach across borders. For joining us for Reading, Writing, Rolling. I am your host, Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds, too. My co-host today is Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions at Mount Carmel College of Nursing and author of several Harry Potter essays. What's the latest with you, Emily?
Well, thanks, Katie. It's the first day of school in my world, so I just had my first group of students today, and everybody's bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
Oh,
and
yeah. It always starts well, the honeymoon period.
That's very true. And I'm excited to have a couple of different essays released this fall, one for the Journal of Worship, which is called Harry Potter and the Sacramental Principle. Ooh. And I've just had another article accepted for publication in this fall's edition of Mythlore, and that is my essay about how house elves are more like robots than they are like elves. So it's an interesting discussion of the science fiction influences of Harry Potter.
So. Very cool. Those are exciting. I know the second article. I don't know the first, but that sounds really fascinating. And you are once again, you're really delivering on a wide array of Harry Potter topics, Emily. That sounds
Ryan.
Cool.
Jack of all trades, master of none.
Well, there's so much good stuff to say. I come up with new ideas all the time, and I often get new ideas when I am attending conferences. And one of the conferences that I have attended is the Southwest Popular American Culture Conference, SWPACA, that's what I say, in Albuquerque. And that is where I met our special guest for today. So let me introduce her to all of you. Our special guest today is Dr. Imbalia Thomas, an applied linguist and assistant professor of TESOL, teacher education, at the University of Kansas. She has her PhD in second language acquisition and teaching from the University of Arizona, and has become a prolific writer on the ways that Harry Potter is useful for pedagogical training, especially for English language learners, but also just for teachers being reflective about themselves. She's also explored the personal dimensions of Harry Potter as a textual critical partner in her own development as a teacher and scholar of color. She's the author of numerous articles on these subjects, and I am just delighted to have her joining us today. Thanks for being on the podcast, Imbalia.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Katie. Hello, Emily. It's great to be here today.
So later in the show, Imbalia, we are going to be joined by your collaborators, Rafael Carnero and Amy Quirin, on a project that you all are doing together regarding Dumbledore's pedagogy particularly. But for now, we wanted to just start with you and ask you a little bit about how you became interested in the world of Harry Potter scholarship. So tell us, Imbalia, how did you first encounter The Boy Who Lived?
Sure. I first encountered the Harry Potter books probably when book three came out. I was working in a summer middle school program and would have lunch with a young student who would sit and read whatever the latest Harry Potter book was at that point. And she was super interested in the book. And for me at that time, as a new teacher, I just thought of it as a kid's book about witches and wizards and not anything very relevant. But once I started spending lunchtime with this young lady, She really got me interested in the books. And I went back and I read the first one, and I kept reading and kept reading, and ended up waiting in line late at night for books. And I just got really involved. And so I'm thankful for that student for kind of tuning me into a book that I had been ignoring for a couple of years. And so, yeah, that's how I got started.
I love that. I love that you were inspired by a young person to read
I
this
was.
Book. Yeah.
Yes, I really was. Yeah, I wish I remember that student's name so that I could email her and just thank her for, you know, giving me this experience. But it shows you what happens when you really kind of tune in to what your students are doing to their lives. And I think for me, that's kind of the power of the Harry Potter books. It allows you to really begin to bridge gaps and to cross borders. And so
when did you first start taking Harry Potter seriously as a focal point for scholarly inquiry?
Well, I started doing that about 4 years ago. I had just entered a teacher education program after graduating in second language acquisition. And though I had taught at the K through 12 level for many years before I became a professor, I had never actually set foot in a school of education. And so I was charged with teaching undergraduates about teaching. And I wasn't quite sure how to do that. So I just fell back on what I knew, my own background knowledge, and started thinking about texts and ideas and concepts that I could share with my students to really help them understand the topic that I was charged with teaching them. And that topic is TESOL, which is teaching English to speakers of other languages, and the process of training new teachers on how to make their content, whatever subject area they're teaching, accessible to students whose first language isn't English. A lot of my students here in the Midwest at the undergraduate level haven't traveled abroad yet. They're not familiar with the process of learning a second language. They don't necessarily know a lot of English language learners because those students are usually in separate classes. And so my goal was to help create some kind of imagined contact for them. And I realized a lot of them had read the Harry Potter books. And I saw a kind of inherent analogy between Harry and Hermione as these border crossers in a way that's very similar to the kind of border crossing that English language learners do in classrooms on a daily basis. And the analogy and the work just kind of took off from there, you know, like, oh, wow, look, you know, there's a lot of similarities between the experiences that Harry and Hermione are undergoing and what some of the students I wanted to teach my students about were experiencing.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I think that is the presentation that, or that some of those ideas were in the presentation that I saw you deliver. It's just so interesting to use
yes.
it. And you call it the Harry Potter border crossing analogy. And you
that's
talk
correct.
About how you're sort of backgrounding some of the other parts of the story in order to foreground, look, you've got this muggle wizard, these two cultures that are living side by side. And here we have Harry and Hermione. And I often forget that Hermione is like this too.
Yeah, you made a really good point, which is I am backgrounding a lot of the wizarding aspects of the book series to kind of foreground something that we take for granted, which is Harry and Hermione and a number of the muggle-born and muggled race characters are foreigners in a sense to this wizarding world. They're entering a new universe, a place where the socio-political context is different, and the language that they have to use in class is different. They are required to learn and use an academic wizarding language and talk about a wizarding world that they didn't grow up knowing. And so when you think about the kinds of challenges, beyond all of the social challenges that they deal with in the book, but some of the inherent challenges to navigating this new space, it's really an opportunity to gain a little bit more sympathy for the people in our real world who are having similar experiences.
Right. And I love this idea that you mentioned earlier of imagined contact. So you don't have to even orchestrate sort of literal face-to-face meetings. You can do, and this is the power of novels in general, you can get students to put themselves in an imaginary situation where they can empathize and even maybe take the perspective of the person who's doing the border crossing.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's imagined contact, but for a lot of students, you know, a lot of the undergraduate and graduate students I've worked with, they are so familiar with these books, with the Harry Potter novels, that the contact isn't very imagined for them. It's a real experience. These characters are real for them. And so though I kind of hint at it being an imagined contact, the familiarity and care that they have for Harry and Hermione kind of really makes that imagined contact real contact. They know what it's like, or they have a sense of what it's like for people who are different and are undergoing these different educational experiences.
And of course, you know, Jo Rowling and her style of writing really helps that process, because, you know, she makes the narrative so inviting for readers to place themselves at least first in Harry's shoes by kind of traveling sort of above Harry's story with her opening remarks about the Dursleys. And then you kind of land right in Harry's shoes by the time the second chapter opens. And then, you know, I think it's really brilliant because, you know, Harry and Hermione deal so differently with their border crossing.
Absolutely.
They have really different approaches. So can you talk a little bit more about how you parse those different approaches with students, or how students themselves notice those different approaches?
Interestingly, we haven't talked about it on that level in terms of just the different responses that Harry and Hermione and some of the other characters have to the border crossing analogies. But just in terms of thinking about those differences and how that information has kind of shaped some of the other work that I've done around the novels. It is this fact that people respond to certain situations in very different ways. And no two English learners are alike. No two educators who work with them are alike. And so delving into the histories, the personal stories, and the environmental context of the characters helps me to be able to emphasize the importance of background and context for my students, and for helping them to think about who they can and want to be as teachers. Question is a really good one, and I want to spend some time thinking about that and talking about it with my students. So thank you for that.
I mean, the reason that I thought of it is pretty simple. I have a very good friend, and she and I have talked about this many times, who approaches every new situation by reading 7 books about it before she enters the situation.
Wow.
And that is so Hermione, you know, and that is a lot of how Hermione deals with her with traversing into this totally new universe.
Absolutely.
But that's also you can only take that approach if you come from a place of privilege. And I think obviously it's clear that Hermione does. She's privileged, you know, materially, but then she's also privileged intellectually. And Harry's, you know, his is more of a kind of a blind immersion into this new world. And that's the more the perspective that we're invited as readers to adopt. You know, Harry's more of this empty vessel for us to pour ourselves into. But Hermione is this kind of more sharply defined character, and yet so many people identify with Hermione as well. I mean, I just think it's really useful. I almost think you could go through and look at all the Muggle-born and Muggle-raised characters and kind of eke information, you know, about their different responses to, you know, Colin Creevy shows up with his camera, you know, and that's his thing. And, you know, Dean Thomas has got his sports posters on the wall, and, you know, they all have their different kind of ins into this new
culture. Absolutely. And that is a really important concept of just the diversity of learners that I do work to communicate with my students. Often when we talk about students who are learners of English in school settings, we just refer to them as ELLs, as though they are this one monolithic group. But one of the things the Rowling books allow you to do is to look at, as you said, look at these individual characters and the insight that we get about them and their background lives from time to time that really help you to see that people may share one category, but the experiences they have are very unique because the background they've had is very unique. Mm-hmm. The home situations they've had, the internal and personal characteristics that they possess make and allow their responses to be unique. And I think that's a very important notion for teachers, especially pre-service or undergraduate students who are going off to become teachers, to think about. Mm-hmm. So though we don't talk about it explicitly in the classroom on that level with each individual character, I would love to do that. But time does not allow me to go that deeply into the novels. One day.
Yeah. Another paper.
But generally, as I approach the teaching of this topic, I keep these characters in mind, and they guide me in terms of thinking about how to approach my own teaching.
Also, one of the things that's so fascinating, I think, about your variety of articles, I think a lot of what we've been talking about is found in an article called Harry Potter and the Border Crossing Analogy, which is in the Teacher Educator, which is a nice journal. Mm-hmm. But you've also taken this in a more personal direction where you are connecting your own career and career experiences and the border crossings that you have done to the Harry Potter reading. So how have you done that connection? How's Harry Potter been of assistance to you in your career travels?
Right. Yeah, this is the part where I tend to get a little emotional talking about my work and especially thinking about the books. As I said, I did start off kind of drawing upon Harry Potter in my classroom to help me navigate the space of teaching students a topic that was new for me. But as a new assistant professor who, having moved to the Midwest after having lived in really large cosmopolitan cities, I personally was struggling with my environment. I was struggling with teaching and just being in a space that was very different from anything I had experienced before, as well as kind of dealing with some of the imposed ways of thinking about new teachers, especially teachers of color, that I was encountering in the School of Education and in this educational environment. And so I started reading poetry and reading Potter, rereading my Harry Potter books, and finding a lot of comfort in thinking about the experiences of Harry and Hermione, but thinking about the experiences of Lupin as a werewolf wizard, and just kind of his desire to teach and the experiences that he encounters in the wizarding world. I thought about Snape and a variety of other characters, and just the challenges of being a teacher.
And Bali, this really reminds me of the article that you have called The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly of Pedagogy in Harry Potter.
Yes.
And that was in The Clearinghouse. And what I really loved about that was that, you've seen a lot of people who talk about the teachers at Hogwarts and are they good teachers or bad teachers? But a lot of what you're talking about in that article is what informs those teachers? Why are they the way they are? Why is Snape the kind of teacher that he is? What is Lupin bringing to the classroom based on his own personal development? And it seems to me that that's also something that you have also been working on as you look at yourself as a teacher, and what are the things that you're bringing into the classroom?
Yeah, when I first started kind of reflecting on Harry Potter as a tool to use with my undergraduate students, I was kind of caught off guard by the fact that I actually related so closely to the teachers in the novel. I mean, it's not surprising. I'm a teacher, they're teachers. And so, I kind of have read the books through a teacher perspective. But as a teacher educator, I began to realize there were some real important truths about teaching and about where our teaching practices come from, our background experiences, the kind of personal ways in which we relate to the world, and how that shapes the practical knowledge that we as educators bring into the classroom. And so I started rereading the books through that lens to be able to share that information with my students. Again, I work with undergraduate and graduate students who are working to become teachers in the K-12 system, or individuals who are going off to become teacher educators themselves. And we often don't get a chance to look at ourselves as teachers through a more sympathetic lens. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to look at three characters, you know, a character that people love, Lupin, a character that people love, but they also think is not that great of a teacher, which is Hagrid. And then a character that people tend not to like immediately, even though lots of people do, and that's Snape. And look at how, you know, we kind of think about them as educators, but then look into the background experiences that shape the ways in which they teach. I loved working on that paper. I loved going through line by line to reevaluate passages that I had just kind of taken for granted, and looking at the passages in terms of how they really give you some insight into who these individual characters are. One of the most surprising bits of insight that I got from rereading the books was this language of practice that you get from Snape. You know, we tend to think of Snape as very droll and very serious in many ways. But when you think about the ways in which he describes potion making with all of this metaphorical imagery and just this very beautiful language, you realize there's a passion there. And that passion is kind of carried throughout the entire series, but it can get lost because of some of the surface things that Snape does when he's teaching. That aspect of self and how it shapes pedagogy is something that I think is really important for teachers to be aware of, and to draw upon that and to channel it in ways that can be very productive within a classroom setting. I've used the same kind of process of looking at my own experiences and personal history to think about, you know, what teaching has been like for me in the past and what it has been like for me as a new professor in the Midwest and as a professor of color in an environment where I'm one of the few professors of color. I see myself, you know, as a Southerner, and the ways in which race and culture and upbringing really impact and shape the way that I teach. And working to create this, you know, culturally responsive way of teaching that is adapted to my Midwest students and the experiences they've had has been both traumatic and enjoyable. I don't know if enjoyable is the right word, but traumatic and career affirming. Like, I have really grown deeply in my understanding of what it means to be a teacher and to engage with students where they are and who they are, and to bring your full self into that space. And yet have a voice that reaches both them and is authentic for who you are. And I think that the novels helped me to get to that place, especially looking at the work and the teaching of those three characters I mentioned before.
I think that's so wonderful. I think too often, you know, one of my many critiques of education system is that it's sort of this industrial model. You know, you put kids in and you pop workers out. And I think sometimes we expect teachers to be like that, too, and how regimented some of the profession has become. And so really being able to nevertheless be your authentic self and to bring all those things in a positive way into the classroom and being aware of some of the ways that maybe that might be hindering you. Those are all just intensely useful and also just very humanistic. And, you know, teaching should absolutely still be a humanistic profession.
Right.
And that's what I love about your whole approach there.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, teachers and people who are going into education today face a real challenge. A lot of teaching is regimented.
Right.
The curriculum is often dictated to you. There's pressure to kind of teach to test. And, we are not necessarily foregrounding for students an authentic and personal way of engaging with those requirements. And I think if any teacher is going to survive in this profession past the first 5 years, they have to be able to really dig deeply into their experiences to bring a regimented curriculum to life for themselves and for their students so that they can enrich and empower themselves, the curriculum that they're offering, and the direction in which they want their students to go. I feel I probably sound a little bit controlled and ordered and measured in terms of how I'm presenting this, but I am so deeply passionate about teachers and the challenges they face in schools today. I mean, beyond all of the school shootings and beyond the pressures for students to perform, being a teacher now is a very tough endeavor, and we have to create and empower teachers to be authentic to themselves and to their reasons for going into the classroom. And I think one of the best ways to be authentic in that experience and in that pursuit is to draw upon knowledge that is deeply personal and relevant to them. For me, Harry Potter has been that.
Yeah, and what's interesting to me is we're talking, of course, J.K. Rowling was a teacher. This sympathetic approach to even a teacher like Snape, is actually, it makes a lot of sense. And one of the things that I really love, again, this is another article that you have, The Girl Who Lived, which was in Pushing Boundaries and Crossing Borders. You talk about how you're putting yourself in conversation with authors and their texts, as a way to deal with some of the trauma of the teaching experience. And you call them textual critical partners. And I wondered if you could talk about how you did that with Harry Potter. How did Harry Potter become a textual critical partner for you?
Well, the textual critical partners actually started a little bit before Harry Potter. It was the idea was inspired by some of the poetry that I had been reading from a couple of feminist writers of color. I had been reading the work of Gloria Anzaldúa and Audre Lorde, and they talk about some of the challenges of being a person of color in academic spaces or in spaces where you are crossing borders, where you are a novelty or perhaps an individual who where space has perhaps not been readily made for you. And so in reading their work, I just felt very acknowledged and moved in terms of my experience being expressed and addressed through their work. Reading their work allowed me to then engage with J.K. Rowling's novels and to dialogue with the characters within those texts, to give voice to my experience through the experiences that were discussed by Hermione and some of the racial prejudice that she ex you know that she experienced through Harry in terms of just the fact that there was a lot of doubting of his ability and his potential as a human being and to have a very weighty task in front of you that you have to accomplish. For me as a new professor, being on the tenure track is a very weighty task. It's like having to fight Voldemort. There are lots of Death Eaters around you in your context. And so, to be able to kind of mediate the anxiety around these experiences through characters, through other voices, surprisingly helped me to find my voice. It helped me to find my voice by looking at some of the headcanon literature, you know, some of the writing that students have and individuals have been doing online around the Rawlings text for years, writing that I didn't even know existed. Mm. And just seeing the ways in which, you know, young people could give voice to a text that they loved and recreate, rewrite, rethink, argue against an established text, and to position the characters and the development of the series in the way that they wanted it to go, I found very, very empowering. And so, again, I am becoming a more fulfilled and fuller and better teacher through the young people and the work that they are doing and the readings that they are engaging in. And that's wonderful.
You said in one of your articles in Balia that fandom and Harry Potter fandom, probably in particular, is often characterized as a very white space, but that this is not really necessarily the case. And you actually find a lot of people who are doing exactly what you said. I'm sort of paraphrasing you here, but you talk about the power of pop culture, including especially maybe fandom, to disrupt hegemony, right? Yes. That it can be this disruptive and critical force culturally.
That's right. Yeah, you know, I have always been one of those Black women who has been the one Black woman that has been in a lot of predominantly white spaces. Mm. But there are a lot of other people of color that have always been in those spaces and who engage in these activities and in fandom practices and who go to, you know, dragon cons and all the different cons. And those voices often get lost. And one of the things that I've seen in fan fiction is this kind of step or this push against the ways in which spaces anticipate and marginalize some people. And so, you know, I want my students to be able to have those same kinds of, not just those experiences, but I want them to take an empowered action as well. I want them, for whatever is the topic that is relevant and worth fighting for them, I want them to look at the ways in which others are fighting against hegemony and to take up whatever mantle they feel is important to take up.
I love that. I love that. And, you know, one of my favorites, in fact, I think my favorite of the articles that you sent Katie and I was the one about demented spaces.
Yeah, the drama article.
And the dementors. Yeah. Man, that was so good because, you know, to be honest, first of all, you know, talk about taking an empowered action. You know, that article itself is, I think, problematic for anybody who has become kind of normatized to this, to unhealthy academic spaces.
Right.
And for somebody to speak out and to say, these are akin to being surrounded by dementors.
Right.
I think, first of all, we have to grapple with that and say, why have we created this space where somebody can make a really fruitful comparison to being, you know, surrounded by beings that are going to suck your soul out, you know, just because you're there, you know?
That's right.
And then secondly, I just thought that the analogies that you made were so apt in terms of the importance of calling down that patron, calling down that advocate that helps empower those of us who are coming up. And that reminds those of us who've been in it for a while to reach down and pull somebody up with you. The idea of mindfulness, you know, that you know, kind of forces you to be in the moment instead of being, you know, three papers down the line or three courses down the line or three committees down the line, you know, being in the moment. I mean, all of it, it was really great.
That paper was hard to write. It was hard to write because it was so deeply personal. It was hard to write because I was concerned that my school and my colleagues would think that the paper was just about them.
Yeah.
And the reality was that I wrote that paper for all of the graduate students and new academics out there who felt like they didn't understand what people meant when they said that there's politics in academia. Mm-hmm. And so that, like, there are lots of us who go into this field and we don't fully understand what it means to be an academic and the process of resocialization that takes place in those first 3 to 5 years is deeply painful for some of us, especially if you are in an environment where you are a little bit different. It may not be a simple issue of you are racially different, but you could be different in so many ways in academia. And that difference just makes the process of adjusting much more complicated. I mean, I moved to a small town in the Midwest at the height of a new presidential administration where race was a real issue. We are about 4.5 hours from Ferguson. And when I moved to Lawrence, that was top of mind. And that just made moving to Kansas a very challenge, you know, a very big challenge for me. It made kind of interacting with people much more difficult and challenging because I wasn't sure where my advocates were. And so that, along with the normal processes of entering academia, made my experience, I think, uniquely challenging for me. But yeah, academia is hard. Yeah. And yeah. There are a lot of forces to produce and to kind of take care of one's own space and work and needs that sometimes mean that new people can be overlooked in ways that aren't very productive. So the paper is really about how to survive that.
Yeah.
And the information and tricks to doing that that can be taken from the Harry Potter series.
And it's not just eat a lot of chocolate.
Yeah, it's but that's not my favorite.
I'm still addicted to the chocolate.
I know. We share that need. It's fucking night and I'm not eating chocolate, well, I don't know what happened, but it must have been a good day. But actually, Molly, I do have a question about that. So you said it was difficult to write, and you said you were fearful that people would take it as about your own institution. But you've probably got, I would hope that you've gotten a lot of positive feedback from those for whom it's been empowering. But have you gotten any negative feedback in terms of the critique of the institution? And secondly, Katie and I are always interested in whether people are getting pushback about academic work that focuses on Harry Potter as if it's as if it's not substantial enough, or if it's too light or too pop culture, you know. So both of those questions, I'm interested to hear what you.
Right. Well, I have to say I have not received any negative feedback from my school or my colleagues about the paper, but it's the Midwest and there's such a thing as Midwest nice, and so perhaps you know, people don't want to say anything about it. But, you know, I didn't write the paper for them. I really did write it for people who were having a really tough go at being, you know, professors or graduate students. And from some of them, I have heard from. I have received emails out of the blue that just say, thank you for writing this paper.
Wow.
Like, I needed to know that my experience is affirmed and I'm not the only one. So that's been great. And if other people read the paper and they feel the same way, please just email me and say, yes, I am there, or I was there. And if you know people who are going through similar experiences where they're just having a very difficult time adjusting to academic life, send them the paper. It's not about citations for me. It is really about making sure that people who have a great potential for being strong academics, that they survive and they make it through those first 6 years on the tenure track.
Something that, that occurred to me when we were talking before, you're talking about, you know, Hermione prepares for going, crossing this border by reading a lot of books, but how does Harry do it? And it strikes me that Harry does it through Ron and through friendship.
Yeah.
And what you are doing is you are offering friendship. You are now kind of in it. And so you are saying, let me hold your hand as you cross into this border with me, to los intersticios, something like that, the interstices, interstices, so that you're literally offering friendship as a way to cross into this strange realm of higher education. And that in itself, I mean, is a lot of what the novels themselves are about.
Absolutely. It's very true. And this level of friendship that is what my textual critical partners, Audre Lorde and Gloria Anzaldúa, provided for me. Mm-hmm. They were that textual voice from the page that really reflected the pain and the experiences that I was going through. And through their poetry, I really survived and thrived. I was not a reader of poetry at all, but I remembered that they existed and went out and found their books and started reading and just and was comforted. And that's what I want this particular paper, Harry Potter, Trauma in the Demented World of Academia. I want that paper to be the textual critical partner for others. And if they want to reach out to me via email, that's good too.
That's great. And that's just, that's in the Journal of Educational Thought, just in case mm-hmm. people are looking for that. Now we're joined by Rafael Carnero, a PhD researcher in applied linguistics with an interest in stylistics and translation studies, who's based in the Federal University of Uberlândia, Minas Gerais, Brazil. And we're joined by Amy Quirin, a PhD researcher in language acquisition and language teaching in the Department of Curriculum and Teaching at the University of Kansas. Welcome to the show, Rafael and Amy.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's very nice to hear from you. And glad we're getting international here a little bit. That's cool too. So Rafael and Amy, I'm really interested to know how each of you got interested in using Harry Potter in scholarly research. Rafael, where did your interest come from?
Well, first of all, I have to say that Harry Potter had a huge impact on my teenage years.
Ah.
So I grew up waiting for the publication of each book. And I can honestly say that I became a reader in earnest only after Harry Potter. Yeah, when I started my English language degree, it was natural for me to want to investigate the series linguistically. And then I took this interest to my master's research, in which I explored the fictional world created by J.K. Rowling by means of a lexical analysis of terms that distinctly build the fictional world and give specificity to it conceptually speaking. As a novel, as a series in the fantasy universe of discourse. So on what concerns Dumbledore, I think he's a very interesting character. He keeps readers guessing at his underlying motives until the very end. And considering that he's an educator, his actions and choices provide food for thought for how he's characterized as such. And his relation to knowledge is a relevant issue to be considered as a topic in teacher education.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, that's very cool. I do think you're right. Dumbledore is this really interesting mystery that you have to piece together over the course of the novels.
Absolutely, yeah.
Really cool. Amy, how about you?
Well, I also read the novels as they were coming out and really enjoyed them. I really liked reading fan fiction and fan theories and essays about the novels in between their publications. But I really didn't ever think about applying my interest in Harry Potter academically until I ran into Mbalia in the department that we both work in. And she had started a new project or was working on the Dumbledore project. And I kind of accidentally noticed something that she had printed off, an article that had to do with Harry Potter. And I commented on it to her. We had never actually worked together before. And she started telling me about these projects that she was working on using Harry Potter. And I just got really, really excited about it and really wanted to be involved with it. And she very generously brought me in on it. So that's really how my academic interest in Harry Potter started, although my interest in the series is really longstanding.
That's cool. The benefits of a shared printer, copier.
Yeah, very true. I was so excited to see that there was somebody else who was super excited in my workspace about Harry Potter. So I was glad to run into Amy.
Yeah. So let's see. I know then Mbalia and Amy, how you got together on this project. Mm-hmm. But Rafael, how did you get looped in to this trio?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. Because I first met Mbalia in a summer school promoted by the Poetics and Linguistics Association in the UK last year. And then we shared the common interest of using Harry Potter as a research object. So as I worked with the Harry Potter corpus for my master's research, which was generally about a lexical analysis of specific terms that characterize the fictional world of the novels. I talked to Mbalia, and then since then, in the Poetics and Linguistics Association conference, we started talking about her ideas on Dumbledore and how we could work together to address her ideas. And then after that, I met Amy online. And then since August 2018, we have been meeting online to work on the project.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah.
I have to add, you know, Raphael talks about the Poetics and Linguistics Association. And as he said, they're UK-based. They have a conference every year. And they have these summer schools where they talk about various topics. And the topic that was the topic for that particular summer school was corpus analysis. And so one of the things that Raphael and I share, as well as Amy, is a love for language and linguistics. Mm-hmm. We are all linguists in a very real sense. And we're trying not to sound linguistically and geeky, but we really are. and so, you know, this PALA conference really kind of speaks to that linguistic side of who we are as scholars and kind of the Dumbledore work that Raphael has referenced.
Yeah, and it seems like what you're doing, because you are doing kind of a literary analysis and even a linguistic analysis in order to understand Dumbledore as a teacher, as a pedagogue, and his philosophy of knowledge based on the kind of language that he uses. Have I got the idea?
Yes, we all say that's true. That's what we're doing. I mean, it's very much a linguistic approach, but it's a pragmatic approach as well. It's really about some of the rules that underlie speech and speaking and interaction and what the responsibilities we hold to others are through these speech acts and the ways in which they are received. So it's a very linguistic take on a very complex and interesting character.
Yeah, and I think you're calling the project the Dumbledore Debate, right?
The great
Dumbledore Debate.
Yes.
Right. And so tell us, how are you carrying out this project? How are you sort of figuring out Dumbledore and good teacher, bad teacher? You know, I mean, I'm sure you're not characterizing it in those simplistic terms, but how are you characterizing this debate, and what are you doing to add knowledge to our understanding of Dumbledore?
I have to say, you know, as I mentioned before, I really care about the characters in the series who are teachers. And so for me, one of the great questions of teaching in Harry Potter is about the role that teachers have with their students, and how as educators, we hope that our students trust us, that they rely on us, but we also have responsibilities to them as educators. And so for me, the question about the morality and ethics of Dumbledore, whether or not he's honest with Harry, how he uses Harry and Snape and different characters, those are really important questions to me as a teacher educator. And through a linguistic analysis of the ways in which Dumbledore expresses his knowledge and expresses when he comes to have certain knowledge, I think is very telling about this larger question of Dumbledore's responsibility to Harry and Snape and other characters. So that's, kind of the linguistic approach to what we're looking at.
In practical terms of how we are carrying it out, I would say that it's kind of challenging. Because it involves analyzing Dumbledore's speeches across the 7 books. So it takes some methods, you know, and some procedures to actually extract his speeches from the whole corpus and then analyze them. So we need electronic versions of the texts, which I already had from my master's project. So I shared them with Mbalia at first, so we could run some tests and see if our ideas would be, you know, feasible to develop it, you know, from a corpus perspective. So after compiling the corpus, we use a lexical analysis software to process the files and then generate word lists, keywords, and concordance lines. that are later on qualitatively analyzed. So through word lists and keywords, we get to select words of interest to be analyzed in context. And starting from this data output, we select those words that in our case we are interested in modal verbs, for instance, and expressions of epistemicity. So then we can analyze these expressions in context and start to get to the more interpretative side of the project, which is trying to understand these issues of epistemic access and epistemic primacy and responsibility. So all of our qualitative statements are based on linguistic evidence from the books.
Yeah, I think this is so interesting because it shows the use of digital humanities as mm-hmm. the sort of buzzword, buzz phrase that people yes. are using now. But the usefulness of computer analytic tools to actually sort of show us some of the things that are happening in the text and the context in which they're occurring and all of that. I think this has a lot of really interesting implications, as you say, for, you know, the understanding the epistemology that's being presented there, that theory of knowledge right. that Dumbledore seems to represent.
So far, we've mostly analyzed Dumbledore's speech, but I think something that I'm really looking forward to is comparing his speech to some of the other major characters to find out what differences exist between them, because like you say, he does seem to sort of embody this theory of knowledge, and it would be interesting to see the ways that other characters shift and change over time through their relationship with him linguistically. To see, I guess what I'm curious about is whether or not the way that he speaks influences characters that he speaks a lot with, like whether or not his speech influences the way that Harry speaks about what he knows.
When you say speeches, do you mean any time he speaks mm-hmm. or?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah, because I really can't wait to see what the final project, because, you know, I mean, sometimes he uses nonsense language.
Yes.
And it's like, is it, you know, does that like throw a monkey wrench into everything that you're, or does it kind of fit some pattern? I mean, I don't know if you've done any preliminary work on that, can comment on that, or if we just have to wait for the final.
Right. I mean, we can share with you what we've been going through, because this is not an easy project at all.
No.
And we don't always agree on how we see Dumbledore. But, you know, we did start off by kind of talking about, you know, what speech patterns marked Dumbledore as a character. And he uses, you know, all of these weird sayings, and, you know, he has, you know, these particular linguistic nuances that mark him as a character. But I think what we then began to realize was more interesting and more relevant in terms of addressing this segment of fan fiction or fan literature and scholarship that's out there that says, you know, Dumbledore wasn't a very moral character because, you know, he withheld information from Harry that was important to him. And, you know, he allowed Snape to work as a double agent. Like, there are people who are really upset with Dumbledore as a character. And and I always loved him as a character. And so one of the things, you know, I realize, and I think that the three of us realize, is that one way to answer or to address this question of, you know, is Dumbledore, you know, moral? Does he treat the characters fairly? Is to really dig deeply into what information Dumbledore knew and when he came to know it. And so when we look at his language, we are looking at the ways in which you know, his language reveals information that he is certain about at certain times in the book, information that he is probably certain about, whether he's sure and who he shares that information with. And that gives us a nuanced sense of what he knows and how comfortable he feels sharing it. So my take on that is that Dumbledore is actually a very ethical person. He's very responsible with characters, and that we can get to that through language. That's my take. But the three of us have had real discussions about, you know, am I or are we reading, you know, particular stances into the data? And that's where I think as scholars, it becomes kind of fun to do this work.
I think that, I mean, I have really broad questions, and so it has been difficult to really narrow things down and look at only what the linguistic information that we have is able to show us. Mm-hmm. And it's been really good practice for me to try to stop, I guess, reading stances into what I'm looking at, and to really try to let the linguistic data speak to me for itself instead of me trying to rearrange it to my liking. So it's been interesting and difficult for me to do.
Yeah. So absolutely. I agree. It's a challenge, right? Looking at the data and then trying to derive, trying to look at the data and also look at the theoretical basis and try to combine them, you know. So, yeah.
Yeah, but it's been fun, you guys. You have to admit, we've had some really some fun discussions, and you know, it's amazing how much textual knowledge we possess about these books, obscure statements and comments and facts that we draw upon in our discussions, and we're like, oh gosh, I didn't realize I even knew that bit of information. But it's been fun, and I think, you know, the biggest takeaway for anyone listening is that, you know, some of the great questions we have about literary characters can be answered through scholarship, through technology, through corpus analysis, and through the digital humanities. And it's work that teachers can engage in with their students. And it allows technology to be incredibly useful in teaching and learning.
That's awesome. I mean, I think that's just a good clarion call, right? Send out to people doing the next stages of Harry Potter research should absolutely include these kinds of analyses. Have you started to develop like a philosophy of knowledge or a philosophy of learning that Dumbledore seems to have? He actually, although he's somebody who knows a lot, I do feel like he's a little humble about, you know, really understanding that there are things he doesn't yet know, or he suspects them, but he doesn't know it well enough. Like I'm thinking about with Slughorn and the Horcrux discussion, he has to basically know what Slughorn told, you know, Tom Riddle, soon to be Voldemort, but he doesn't know for sure. So he does feel like he needs that extra information. Absolutely. So I wonder if you have developed some theories about his way of thinking about knowledge.
Yes, thanks for asking that question, because it is an important one. I would say I don't think I personally have a theory as of yet, but I do have a stance, and it's one that I write this paper with so that I can share with my students who are going off to be teachers. And that is, it is okay not to know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the beauties of Dumbledore as an educator, is that he willingly acknowledges when he does not know something or when he cannot tell the full truth. And I think as educators, we find ourselves in situations where we cannot always share with our students information that we have, even when we want to. We do not always have knowledge, but we are willing to go off and find that information and to share it with them. It is such pressure to be in a classroom with 20 to 40 faces looking up at you and feeling like you have to respond with some brilliant answer. And through the examples that Dumbledore and specifically his language from the text show us, I think it's possible to show students and future teachers and current teachers that it is okay to not know and to admit to not knowing. So that for me is the purpose of this Dumbledore corpus work that we are doing.
I align with that. The longer I'm in the classroom, the more willing I actually am. I guess it's a sign of confidence, right? And experience to say, I have no idea. I don't really know that.
That's right.
What are some good questions that we could put forward and try, you know, how could we find the answers to those? But when you're first starting out, it's actually, I totally identify with that. Like, you know, you feel like you have to have all the answers at the ready.
Absolutely. And that puts a lot of pressure on teachers, on new teachers in particular, especially young teachers. There is a process of coming to know what you do and don't know. And I think Dumbledore is just the perfect example of showing that process. You know, this knowledge of the Horcrux and what it means for Harry and what it means for the defeat of Voldemort is knowledge that unfolds over the course of the seven books. And really looking at that unfolding of knowledge for Dumbledore is something that I think that most human beings who have to be knowledgeable can relate to.
Yeah, and I think you're really hitting a sweet spot also for fans of the novels, because that question of, like, did Dumbledore know about Horcruxes when Harry gave him the diary that he had, you know, and when did Dumbledore know this stuff, and how much, you know, do
that's
we hold
right.
him accountable for holding things back? I mean, I love the idea that you're actually, you know, showing us a way that those questions can be answered satisfactorily through the texts themselves.
Absolutely.
And it's a countercultural message as well, in terms of the unfolding of knowledge in this kind of graceful way, and the willingness to admit to not knowing. I mean, this is something that's great advice for, you know, maybe beginning or young academics, but it's also, you know, how the books kind of speak to the world, you know, as our technology develops and as there's such an emphasis on data and understand, you know, understanding data where you know, where is the wisdom in how we use the data, and where is the wisdom in how the data is shared? And I think that it seems like your study will have a lot to say to that as well.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, it definitely has implications for, you know, for people at all points in their career. And so, yeah, absolutely.
So what's the next step for your research? What's next for you all?
Well, I guess from my perspective, I feel like we're still kind of in the midst of the Dumbledore question. So really still tackling that and going through the data and trying to figure out the best way to try to analyze it. And then after that, I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the next step would be.
Yeah, you have to see what you've got, right?
Right. That's right. But Amy's had some really interesting thoughts around where that work would unfold in the future for her as well. And I don't know, Amy, if you remember some of the conversations we've had about that.
I think the methods that we're using for this are really interesting to me when it comes to maybe looking at writing around education, more specifically, more traditionally academic writing about education, looking at some of these same methods that we're using, because I'm learning a lot about how to use these methods and these ways of analyses for research. So thinking about the way that education researchers write about language acquisition and language teaching, and looking at some of those kinds of pieces of writing in this systematic way with corpus analysis is really interesting to me. This project is really helping me learn how to use some of those methods and skills in a way that I find very personally enjoyable.
Yeah, so I agree with Amy. We still have to kind of try to perhaps adjust the methodology in a way that it's going to fit our, you know, main ideas in terms of the theory we're using, the idea of morality of conversation and pragmatics. So yeah, we still have to have a look on those differences in relation to how duty is expressed or obligation, and then to determine those ideas of what, when, and how Dumbledore knew things, and, you know, address these things in a way that's methodologically sound, I would say.
Yeah, this is so fascinating to me, this kind of intersection between linguistics and education and literature. What a just really fascinating conversation that this has produced. And so, you know, I'm really looking forward to seeing where your project goes ultimately. To ask like a last question of each of you, if you were going to be giving advice to Harry Potter researchers in the academy, what advice would each of you give? Let's start with Raphael.
Well, I would advise other scholars to stick to their purpose. You know, I would say Harry Potter research is a worthwhile and rewarding endeavor and fun as well. So I think they shouldn't be discouraged by criticism leveled at working with the children's book, for instance, because people sometimes get prejudiced. Oh, you're working with the children's book. So as something that would be, you know, less, you know, that doesn't merit an effort, you know.
Well, how about you, Amy? Would you have advice?
I would kind of echo what Raphael said, that there might be judgment, or a person might feel fear of judgment that what they were doing was frivolous. Maybe not even just because it's a children's book, but because it's something that's very popular. Mm. And so it might be kind of looked upon as being, I guess, less serious intellectually, but there's so much space in academia for all different kinds of subject matter of research that if it's interesting and you're producing something that's interesting and worthwhile, then you shouldn't worry about those kinds of judgments.
That's a great point. There's room for all of us, right?
Yeah, and I echo what Amy and Raphael have said. I mean, I think the nature of doing work in popular culture, and especially something like Harry Potter, may make some people think that this is not serious scholarship. But when you approach work from a place of just honesty and deep intellectual curiosity, that work will be interesting and relevant, and it will touch people, and it can impact change. And so I think it's important to go forth with the scholarship that you are interested in. In particular, I think of the band Harry and the Potters, and, you know, they've been around for ages now, and, you know, what may have started out as a lark for them has turned into something that now they are really looking at with a lot more social and political voice. And so, you know, I think of the Harry Potter scholarship that we are doing in that vein, that it may have been something that kind of started from, you know, a place of just deep intentionality. I didn't expect it to take on the life that it has. But with time and need and necessity and interactions with students and other types of writing, it has really become a space of social and political activism and personal voice for me. So go forth with whatever popular cultural text that someone wants to write about or talk about.
You know, I totally agree with that, with those ideas that you all have expressed. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that's actually really toxic in academia is the way we let other people decide what counts as important.
Right.
And I also had the experience in Balia of feeling kind of silence. I think I felt like I was burned out on my academic research, and I did not begin to publish very much, or really I didn't become very active until I started getting into Harry Potter, and that had this effect of opening me up to all kinds of other things as well.
Yes.
And
yes.
Another of our guests, Beth Sutton Ramspeck, she said the same thing, that for her
right.
it was like a post tenure thing where I think that there are these ways that people are making meaning in our culture.
Right.
And just because it's popular doesn't
right.
mean it's not also something that is important and worth talking about. And if it's something that actually helps you to, you know, to be vocal and to think
right.
about yourself in relation to others, then that makes it very valuable to do. And you can't listen to the naysayers.
Absolutely. Yeah, Katie, that's a really great thing to end on, because for me, once I started writing this Harry Potter scholarship, I mean, it's like the dam burst. Like, I have been writing fast and furious.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I feel so incredibly inspired. I feel unleashed, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I was trying to be an academic that I was not. And
mm-hmm.
the truth is that, you know, I am one of those random people that you will find, you know, out listening to Harry and the Potters and enjoying that. And I needed to bring that space to my work. And in doing that, I have just been able to write about a lot of other things that in addition to the Potter work. So yeah, you have to be true to yourself. And when you find something that allows you to really express that voice, it's amazing what can then happen for you.
I will say that Harry and the Potters, they're particularly clever.
Yeah,
that's true.
Their lyrics are like, you know, I mean, you see all these kids like, you know, up front, like jumping up and down in their concerts, and like, I'll be in the back just laughing. You know?
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. They were actually here in Lawrence last night. And it just shows you that I've reached that point in life where, you know, I can't stay up to 8 o'clock to your house. Right. I missed it. But I've seen them before. And, you know, I think if they can go out and they can do this well into adulthood, then, you know, hey, I can write about just about anything. Yeah. I have to say, though, that just because I write about these topics does not guarantee that I will make tenure. I realize that. But I do know that whatever happens in this career, I can walk away from it saying I have done my best work. That this is true and honest for me, and may the next, you know, generation or evolution of academics who go forth use this to help them in their work with students or with, you know, whoever they're working with. So that's where I stand on this.
Right. And I do think that what you're doing is tenure worthy, if I may say so. And I think you're doing some really wonderful stuff that is not only great for the Harry Potter world, but also for teacher education and for linguistic study and for these, you know, talking about bringing yourself into the scholarship that you're doing. I think it's really cutting edge. And part of that is, as you've been talking about, because you're willing to cross over some of these disciplinary borders and, you know, the culture, pop culture border, and all of those things that is making, I think, some really brilliant contributions. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Katie and Emily, for this opportunity for us to talk about a topic that is of importance and interest to us.
This has been such a really interesting conversation, and I'm sorry to bring it to a close, but thank you so much, Imbalia Thomas, Rafael Carnero, and Amy Quirin, for being on the podcast today.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you all.
It was so nice to talk with you, and I think we got a chance to think about how Harry Potter can be both a personal and a pedagogical resource for talking to each other and talking across borders in general. Thanks to you, Emily, for being our expert guest today.
Always a pleasure.
And I'd like to give a big thanks to our technical editor in Australia, Emma Nicholson. Thanks for all you do, Emma. You are the best. And as always, we appreciate our partners at MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. They're having their 20th anniversary this year, which is just amazing. And our MuggleNet producer, Lori Beckoff. And Lori is also doing great things for us. Thank you very much, Lori. Dear listeners, we are also so glad that you joined us, and we would love it if you would leave a comment or question for us. Please share your thoughts at readingwritingrolling@gmail.com, readwriteroll on Twitter, or on our Facebook page. In this episode, I really think we have examined the power of both words and voice, how appropriate for a linguistic conversation. And so I'm going to leave you with the wisdom of Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, who said, "Words are, in my not so humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it." We'll see you next time when we'll be using our words to make some magic.